TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Greg Palast, 911, and the Iraqi oil fields. At his recent talk for Project Censored, the investigative journalist Greg Palast showed us a document from the inside of the U.S. State Department, the, quote, post-conflict plan for the economy of Iraq, was written a year before we knew that there was going to be a conflict with Iraq. In this talk, Greg Palast traces the oily connections of 911 and war all the way up to Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force. They, too, looked at a map of Iraq in their secret meetings. Greg Palast showed that map when he spoke at the end of April 2004 at Sonoma State University. Friends and staff of Project Censored had invited him. He's one of their top recipients of the annual Most Censored Stories Awards. Greg Palast, whose films, books, and articles have a huge and devoted audience in Europe via The Guardian and the BBC, can't get his work shown or printed in the mass media in the U.S., where he was born. Here is Greg Palast.
I keep getting these Project Censored Awards. I want to say I'm grateful, but it's like winning a Project Censored Award is like having a worse seller. You know, it's like, it's because it's an award you get for your story not getting reported. You know, I have to do it through these pirate outfits like BBC Television where I work. And, okay, we got to go through some ancient history first. Back to Mesopotamia. So I want to go back to a speech of March 17 of last year when our president spoke to the American people, you know, and he gave Saddam 48 hours to get out of Iraq, where we were sending in the 82nd Airborne to get him. And now, you know, I understand tomorrow he's going to do another speech where he's going to give the Iraqis 24 hours to get out of Iraq. He's had it. But I want to go back to what he said. He said at that time, I have his speech from the paper of record. This is not censored, right? From the Times. He said, I want to speak directly to the Iraqi people. I thought he'd say something like, you know, our kids are coming in to liberate you. Don't shoot them. Instead, he said, and I'm quoting, he said, do not destroy oil wells. I don't make this up. You got to. So why do we go to war? I heard some of you think that it's because of the oil. That's a bad attitude. I wouldn't have believed that until this document flew into my hands. This is a document which is the part of a bigger document called the Iraq Strategy, and it is the post-conflict plan from inside the U.S. State Department, post-conflict plan for the economy of Iraq, which was developed and written more than a year before we were told that there was going to be a conflict in Iraq. Well, on the other hand, it's very nice of them to think about the economy of Iraq. Right? And you know, like, maybe, you know, I looked through it, you know, like, maybe they turn on the water, you know, hook up the electric lines or something. None of that in here. Instead, you'd get all kinds of interesting things about imposing a flat tax, a flat income tax on the country, eliminating all tariffs in the nation, make it the first free trade zone, entire nation is a free trade zone in the world, rewriting the property tax laws, 100% foreign ownership allowed of businesses, privatization of all, and the word is all, state assets, the State Department kindly arranging on page 45 to write the application of Iraq to the World Trade Organization. That's nice of them. Kind of fun document. Page 73 is kind of caught my eye because it called for the privatization and asset sales of concessions, leases, management contracts, especially those in the oil and supporting industries. Especially the oil. Oh, so I've been doing some investigating on this. Some of this has now come out. And I spoke to the people that worked on it. I found out who wrote the 200-page appendix called Options for the Future of Iraq's Oil. 200 pages. And that was written by representatives of ConocoPhillips Oil, Shell Oil, the James Baker Institute, and to balance it out, the Council on Foreign Relations. There was an Iraqi on the committee. He worked for Conoco. Okay. So I was kind of interested in this. And something else caught my eye. When news suddenly, people disappear. You know, people disappear just like they do in, you know, in Latin America. Jay Garner, remember him? He was the first kind of viceroy, our first pasha that we put into Iraq after we took over. General Jay Garner. And Jay Garner is, the night he arrives in Baghdad, he gets a call from Donald Rumsfeld. Don't unpack. You're out. Before that, leading up to that, he was savaged. He was called hapless, incompetent. This point, this appointee of the president was called hapless, incompetent, unlikable. I mean, it was a nasty hit job, which came from within the White House. And our papers were happy to put it out as the fact. Now, why in the world would the White House do a hit on their own guy? And not just a hit. It was devastating, nasty, brutal, disfiguring. It was like a KGB hit out of, you know, like a Le Carré novel, right? So I went back to something Garner had said. See, he had heard, and I met with Jay Garner, my BBC television crew. No one else was bothering with him. I went down to speak to him a couple weeks ago in Washington. And see, after when he first was appointed the viceroy, he'd heard the president talk about democracy. So he got the wrong impression. He thought it had something to do with elections. So he arrives, the minute he hits the ground in the Mideast in Kuwait City, he says, within 90 days of Saddam's statute going toppling, we're going to hold elections. Iraq for Iraqis. And he even said, and I quote, Iraqi oil for Iraqis. So I went to Jay Garner and I showed him this. And in particular, I showed him, apparently what he ran afoul is Appendix B. Appendix B is very interesting, because Appendix B is a schedule, which runs 120, 180, 240 days. These are benchmarks, 360 days. That's what's needed to privatize, to chop up and sell off and take over the oil and all the other state assets and remake this nation. 360 days. Well, there's a problem, see. Because if you hold elections in 90 days, it's very hard to then rewrite their laws to take their oils over 360 days, which is what you need, see. And so there's the 90 days and the 360 days. So there was a problem. There was a problem. And they solved it by Jay going with his 90 days. But I asked Garner if he knew about this document. I showed him. He said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, very elaborate plan. See, and he said, So I said, well, what were you going to do with this plan? I mean, it has 360 days that you needed. He said, well, yeah, I was going to give it. And he had a little smile on his face, the general. And he said, I was going to give it to a legitimate Iraqi elected government, and they could do with it what they wanted. So he was replaced. You know, he knew some Arabic. He was very well liked in Iraq because he had controlled the northern zone after the Gulf War and was known and liked there. So they removed him and they put in a guy who didn't have any Middle East experience, but he was highly qualified, Jerry Bremer, because he had worked for 3 decades as a business partner of Henry Kissinger, which you read, right? Who immediately, or I say immediately, September 19th, he signs Order 37, Order 39, Order 40, Order 17. What are these orders? September 19th. Orders to privatize, sell off to foreign operators 6 of the major Iraqi banks, to impose a flat tax, what the right wing of America had always wanted by fiat, to eliminate all tariffs, and I'm told by Global Exchange, which is running development projects now in Iraq, said you thought that the carpet bombing B-52s was bad. You should see what happened when they hit Baghdad with the Chinese junk, which caused the complete collapse of the industrial sector. 50% unemployment. And as Jay Garner noted, when they fired all the soldiers, their pension was they got to keep their gun. Order 19, Order 17, Order 37... What was interesting to me was not just what was in those orders, but how they each began. Jerry Bremer begins, I, Paul Bremer III, under my authority, under the usages of war, order the following. The usages of war. The usages of war. So what was the war useful for? So I went back to the document in Jerry Bremer's orders, and I'm looking at the document, and I'm sniffing. I smelled Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist. I could tell, flat taxes, no tariffs. You name it, Grover Norquist. Now, if you don't know Grover Norquist, every Wednesday in Washington, D.C., Grover convenes a meeting. See, he was the lobbyist for Microsoft, American Express, and all these big operators. Now he runs this front for the kind of a billionaires union for calling, which is for flat taxes. And he gathers every Wednesday in Washington the corporate lobbyists and the lobbyists from the National Rifle Association, the Christian Coalition, the editors of National Review, 70 of the right-wing stars. It's kind of a luncheon where the vicious meet the avaricious. And they plan out the weekly program for the week and the propaganda line, which will go in your daily newspapers for the week. And when I looked at the particulars of these orders under the usages of war and in this document, I smelled Grover Norquist, or as unkind people say, Gopher Nose Twist. And I went to Gopher and I said, recognize it? And he said, do you want my author signature? He was proud of his great work in helping draft the particulars. But what was very interesting to me is he said, look, the model, and this is where Jay Garner didn't get it. Okay, he said, the model is Pinochet's Chile. See? He said, you gotta get the economics right first. There are some things cannot be left to a democratic vote. Oh, So we don't get a Democratic vote. We got new switch. We got sovereignty. Quick, can our president spell sovereignty? Okay. Of course, like Garner told me that these plans, and so did Norquist, said plans began right after September 11th. They're keeping to the line. But then, see, talking to the oil execs, see, our vice president is now, in fact, today I believe was the arguments, is that correct, Matt, before the Supreme Court, in which our vice president had a gathering today with his fishing buddy to determine whether he should open his files on his meeting with oil company executives when they're having the so-called Energy Task Force meetings. And he said, no, we can't open those up because those are really national security matters. And believe it or not, this is one case in which I agree with the vice president. Okay? And I'll tell you why. Okay? See, because I got some of those documents that were in those meetings. And you'll notice, this is very interesting, we talked about it, the U.S. Energy Task Force, right? We're all looking for that Enron. Enron was in the meeting, so the Enron fix that came through. But what's interesting in the meetings that they had this, a map of a certain Mesopotamian nation. The Tigris and Euphrates and black splotches all over it, each speckle representing an oil field, right? As lawyer got it, the good guy, Tom Fitton, very conservative, who was running he was in a campaign to push the administration into the war with Iraq. He said, this is a little embarrassing. He says, I'm sure there's an innocent explanation. And so he's the one who actually very conservative Republican who asked Cheney for the information. And Cheney said, sue me. See, it's a national security matter because, see, the oil policy is coming out of a barrel of a gun. See? So we ended up with the meetings. I've now spoken to people in meetings, people who were involved in the drafting of the programs, who said that basically the meetings began for the discussion of the options for Iraq's oil began before they could take back the rental suits from the inaugural, basically in the first couple weeks of the administration. That's from the participants. Okay, I'll be reporting that in Rolling Stone pretty soon from Guantanamo. And since we last talked, we've had the September 11th commission. Right? And so now we know what happened, right? We got it all. You move along. The September 11th commission. Great watching Condi Rice here. They were using a Three Stooges defense. We couldn't see anything, you know, like, boink, boink. You know, Larry Moe and Curly Joe. I mean, and this is their defense, right? Right. You know, I'm laughing. I actually had an office in the World Trade Center. But you have to laugh, otherwise you won't make it. Was this just, you know, Knucklehead City? Was it just Larry Moe and Curly Joe? Was this a pratfall, or was this a policy? And FBI agents came to us, came to BBC, people working at BBC, National Security News Service, and to ask us some questions. And when they left a set of documents by accident on the desk, you know, a file. Was, whoop. And what was in it, which I reported on BBC, which you saw on CBS. Dan, actually, yeah, Fox. Dan Rather, actually, I have to say, was on my show in Britain, Newsnight, speaking to another reporter. He said that there are important questions I, as a journalist, know I must ask, but I won't. Not in America. Because if I asked these questions in America, I would be lynched as unpatriotic. Dan Rather, look it up on the BBC website. Or in the new elections edition of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It looks like it's the last election, so it's going to be a collector's item. So. Oh, so the FBI agents, they gave us this. This is part of it, the document. And it says secret on top. I always go for stuff that says secret. Sucker for it. 199I, which means National Security Document, WF, Washington Field Office of the FBI, and it said, you know, blah, 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 they're looking to investigate. Basically, they're hoping to investigate, but obviously they can't until they get this authorization. They're held up from investigating something called a suspected terrorist organization. Some of the FBI agents actually did think their job was to go get the bad guys, but who was it that they couldn't investigate until September 13th, 2001? And you turn to the next page, and there it says, Omar and Abdullah bin Laden. Okay. Now, why? Now, one thing I want to tell you, because I get it all the time, and I'm not kidding, I have zero evidence that George Bush knew in advance about the attack of September 11th. You know, I mean, and, you know, the BBC rule is that anyone ever accuses Bush of knowing anything has got to have documentation. So of course, but it's not about what he knew. It's about not knowing and not wanting to know. We couldn't see because we were blinded. And we were blinded not because our president wanted my office building to fall down. No. By the way, the FBI's answer, they authenticated the document to BBC. And they said, there's certain things Americans should not know. That's what they told the BBC. But they said, low-level agents don't necessarily know our bigger plan. So we talked to high-level guys, DIA, CIA, and they said, can't look at anything that leads back to the money coming from Saudi Arabia. And you don't quote other writers, but this guy's terrific. The old head of operations at the CIA, Robert Bayer, has said today, he said, the September 11th committee never said the words Saudi Arabia. He says, that's like investigating the assassination of Lincoln and not mentioning the Civil War. You know? So it's a no-go area for two political parties, okay? But especially this one. And I also actually did a one-hour special for BBC television, which we discovered that there was a meeting held in May of 96 in Paris, in which the Saudis Saudi billionaires agreed to pay money to al-Qaeda, basically hush, you know, kind of protection money to al-Qaeda. But that wasn't followed up. Okay, that wasn't followed up by this administration because you couldn't follow the Saudi money chain. But I was interested, who was in that meeting that couldn't be followed? And there are two people in that meeting who were business associates and partners of the Bush family, okay? And as Robert Bayer told me, because I've used him as a source, he was head of CIA operations, he said, you want to kill your career in the agency? He said, suggest that we investigate the president's daddy's business partners or the president's former business partner. He says, you know, that's not exactly your career maker. But that doesn't mean our president isn't trying to get to the bottom of this. As you know, that from that lawsuit against the families of the victims of September 11th have sued the Saudi government, okay, for funding the guys that are killing us. And the president's so concerned that he's appointed a lawyer on the case, and he's put him in, actually given him an office in the White House. Of course, it's James Baker, who's the guy who represents the Saudis against the victims of September 11th. So James Baker III is the lawyer who represents the Saudi Defense Ministry against the families of victims. And our president is, right now, he has an office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, he's a lawyer who not only represents the Saudis, he represents ExxonMobil Corporation. He is the special counsel to Carlyle Group. And, of course, he was the lawyer in Bush v. Gore, not for Mr. Gore. So, actually, Baker introduced himself, according to my BBC colleagues who were in Moscow a few months ago, Baker introduced himself to an audience of oil oligarchs. He's looking for more business, right, for his firm Baker Botts. And he introduced himself, because they didn't know who this guy was. He says, look, I'm the guy who fixed the election in Florida for George Bush. He was kidding, of course. Come on. Come on. Especially, you know that the election wasn't stolen, so how could he take credit for it anyway, right? I called the White House. I said, what about this? You know, Henry Kissinger had to run away from the September 11th committee with his consulting firm tucked between his legs because he didn't want to reveal or get rid of his conflicts. On the other hand, James Baker is like a conflict Christmas tree. So I called the White House. I said, how does he get an office in the White House? And they said, well, it's because he's actually not appointed by the president. He's appointed by the Governing Council of Iraq. In other words, the guys that we installed, the puppet government we installed at gunpoint, appoints the president's lawyer as their lawyer. In other words, there's some very good uses for puppets. That's what we call sovereignty as opposed to democracy.
That was the first half of an hour-long talk by the investigative reporter Greg Palast. He spoke for Project Censored at Sonoma State University in Northern California. His international bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, had just been updated and reprinted. In the second half of his talk, Palast explains electronic voting. You may have already voted, he says, and will soon find out how. You can find more information on Greg Palast's website, www.gregpalast.com. Palast is spelled P-A-L-A-S-T. Or go to the link to his website on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with Greg Palast by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.